You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, movies have changed the way we talk and added catchphrases to our conversations. We'll ask for the movie lines that have become part of your vocabulary. Right now, construction on the Foxconn technology plant in Mount Pleasant is scheduled to start this spring. The company has promised to create up to 13,000 jobs. But the company needs to acquire local property to build the plant, and there are people living in houses on some of that property. The village of Mount Pleasant has designated some of those properties as blighted in order to use its power of eminent domain. It's left homeowners feeling frustrated and has some questioning the legality of the move. Lawrence Tabak is a writer based in Madison. He recently wrote a story about this for Belt Magazine. Lawrence, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, talk us through what's happening here. How many people are living on these sites that Foxconn would need for this plant?
Well, probably the first thing to consider is just the size of this project. Until I drove the perimeter, I really didn't have a feel for it, but it's a huge area. It's about 4.5 square miles. And that's bigger than the footprint of Racine itself, which is a town of 77,000. So naturally, when you take a plot of land that large, you're going to have people living there. Even though it is largely agricultural and rural, there were probably about 100 homeowners that were affected by the designation last October that this land would be designated for commercial development by Foxconn.
And so what happens next? People live there. Foxconn needs this to build. What is what's happening in terms of offers or possible condemnations for these homeowners?
Well, that's really the rub. The village of Mount Pleasant basically has promised Foxconn this land. And as you stated in your intro, construction is scheduled to start in April, as soon as the snow goes away, which is actually May. But things are starting to move very quickly. And the fact is they have not resolved all the homeowner issues and property owner issues within that plot. So in October, they issued a letter to those homeowners with the notice that they would be subject to an eminent domain action. And I was surprised, as maybe some of the listeners will be, that eminent domain can be enacted for commercial purposes. I always thought of it as freeways and stadiums and things like that, but there is a Supreme Court decision called Kelo versus New London, which was a 5-4 decision in 2005, in which the Supreme Court said commercial development can be acceptable for the process of taking people's land.
Now, in some of the cases and some of the individual homeowners you've talked to, their house would be declared blighted. Is that right?
Right. And that's part of this Kelo decision, because after the Supreme Court made this decision, 42 states, including Wisconsin, decided that they needed to do legislation to help protect their citizens. And so they toughened the eminent domain laws. And in Wisconsin, the only possible way that Mount Pleasant can take the land is to designate it as blighted and condemn it. So for the people that live there, that, as some of the people have said, is an insult, and it's very personal. I mean, this is why people have really reacted to this story and connected to this story.
Is there a legal definition of blighted?
Well, it has to meet certain criteria, and this is where the problem comes for Mount Pleasant. For instance, one of the criteria in the statutes in Wisconsin is that the crime rate in this area be three times the prevailing rate in the community, which makes no sense at all when you're talking about farmland with scattered houses. There's probably no crime there at all. But there's no other way that the city, the municipality, can get to eminent domain without the blight designation. So for the people that live there, it's an insult. For the village supervisors, it's simply a legal term.
Talking to Lawrence Tabak about a piece he wrote for Belt Magazine on the Foxconn development and the use of eminent domain to acquire property and houses from people living on the proposed site. And Lawrence, you went to a community hearing on this where some of the homeowners involved talked to local officials. Set the scene for us.
Well, the first stage of eminent domain turns out to be an announcement that they've begun the process and to ask for public feedback. and there's a 15-day period for feedback. There was also an open hearing. And this is where I heard from all of the land owners and homeowners who spoke at this meeting. It was really heartrending because these are people who have lived on their homes, some of them generational. Some of them have built dream homes just within the last year. And, you know, they're out in the country. They're in a bucolic, you know, rural area, probably the least place you would ever imagine that someone would come and say, by the way, we need to bulldoze your house for a project.
Now, this wouldn't be without compensation. What would these homeowners get, or what are they being offered currently?
Right. It's actually in the U.S. Constitution that a property cannot be taken without just compensation. The question is, what is just compensation? And in Wisconsin, it's defined as fair market value before the project was announced. And this is where some of the people that live there are having problems. They feel that a fair settlement would be a replacement value for their homes rather than what they would have sold, you know, 6-8 months ago before the Foxconn announcement. Land prices have gone up. There's a lot of people looking for houses now that have been relocated. The market has changed, and some people are going to be well underwater if they just get that assessed value.
And you wrote that at least some of the farmland that was bought up got a much higher payoff, in a way, 5 times the value in some cases than is being offered to the property owners.
That's correct. And that was clearly a sign that Mount Pleasant, in its initiative, wanted to get the large chunks of land first. So they went to the people that owned hundreds of acres and said, we will give you $50,000 an acre, which was at least 5 times the market value. And they locked them all in and in such a way obtained, you know, probably 85% of the land they needed. Now we're talking about the remaining 15%, and they haven't been nearly so generous with those homeowners that just have an acre or two.
Is it thought that there's going to be a legal challenge by these homeowners?
That seems almost inevitable unless something changes. It looks like a showdown, and it could get ugly. 7 homeowners have already filed in federal court, and other homeowners are probably being put in a position where they are considering such. And, you know, the experts that have come and looked at the situation, including a lawyer from the firm that argued the Kelo Supreme Court case, have said this is a clear case of eminent domain abuse. And they have told the Board of Supervisors that you will lose should it come to court.
Do you have a sense of what the local community in Mount Pleasant is thinking of this, apart from the people on this board and the homeowners themselves?
Well, based on the recent vote, there was an election for supervisors, and there was a sort of a split between the pro eminent domain and people who were willing to try to come to other kinds of resolutions. And 3 out of the 4 seats went to sort of the status quo, people that were willing to okay the eminent domain process, which indicates that there's a lot of voters, even though it's a small turnout, who are not as upset about this as the people directly affected.
And just briefly, as this is going on, Foxconn construction hasn't started yet, but you say there is a facility up and running with some temporary workers?
Yes, they've opened up a small assembly facility in a decent-sized warehouse, about the size of a Costco store. It's a big place, and they're putting together TVs under the Foxconn brand with imported parts. And they're training supervisors there, and they have their first assembly workforce, the first hourly wage workforce, which they estimate will be about 3/4 of their total workforce if they get to the 13,000 target. And so it was interesting to see, well, how are those people doing? How much are they getting paid? Because that will be a pretty good indicator of what a large part of the workforce will be looking like in the future.
And what did you find out?
Well, I found out that it was a far cry from the $54,000 average salary that has been touted as sort of the benchmark. These people were making close to half that, about $14 an hour. And as they've done in their other locations, the workers were generally, In fact, all the ones we talked to were working through temporary agencies rather than for Foxconn directly.
We'll leave it there for now. Lawrence, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Tabak is a writer based in Madison. He joined us to look at the use of eminent domain in Mount Pleasant to clear the way for the Foxconn manufacturing plant. He has a piece on thebelt.com. We recently came across an article in the Washington Post called 40 Comedies from the Past 40 Years That Changed the Way We Talk. The author listed a lot of examples of famous lines from movie comedies, from Airplane to Bridesmaids, that have become so common in our daily conversation we might forget that they actually came from movies in the first place. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is there a movie line, a catchphrase maybe, that's part of your conversation or your joking conversation with your friends? What's your all-time favorite movie line? Has a line seeped into the way you or someone you know talks? Or maybe you're annoyed by someone who's always quoting movies. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We put together a supercut of some of the movie lines mentioned in the article. See if you can recognize them.
Shirley, there must be something you can do.
I'm doing everything I can. Now stop calling me Shirley.
You'll shoot your eye out, kid.
If you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11.
Bueller. Bueller.
I'll have what she's having.
All right, all right, all right.
All righty then.
I'm outing.
Ugh, as if.
Hello.
Whatever.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mundus.
Show me the money.
Yeah, baby.
Bye, Felicia.
I'm the dude.
And one time, at band camp.
All you gotta do is say earmuffs to him. Earmuffs.
There are no rules in this house. I'm not like a regular mom. I'm a cool mom.
It's nice.
Great success.
Ready to party.
That escalated quickly.
Rachel Vasquez joins me with more movie lines. She's a producer here on Central Time. Rachel, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Rob.
So do you have this maybe in your circle of friends, your families, where there are a couple of lines that keep coming up again and again?
I would say definitely in my family. My mom, Terry Vasquez, is a known frequenter of the Home Shopping Network. And so she constantly has packages delivered, and because of that, my dad often relies on one from Miracle on 34th Street, which from his version is, there's a lot of bad isms in this world, but the worst is commercialism.
Here's a listen to the original.
That's what I've been fighting against for years, the way they commercialize Christmas.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad isms floating around this world, but one of the worst is commercialism.
Does he just say it like that, commercialism?
He does. He says,
excellent.
The waste.
That's great. And you've got one from Elf, too, right? Let's pull that one up. What is we got it? All right, here it is.
Bye, buddy. Hope you find your dad.
Thanks, Mr. Narwhal.
And this is one you use?
It's my favorite. If you are around me at any point within 2 months before or after the holiday season, I am saying goodbye to you like this.
Well, let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Leonard is with us in Rice Lake. Leonard, hi.
Hi.
What line do you have for us?
Jack Nicholson's line from the movie As Good As It Gets.
What's the line?
So crazy somewhere else. We're all stocked up here.
Okay, that's a pretty good one. I heard you're going to say something about Jack Nicholson. Of course, I thought, here's Johnny from The Shining. But that's a pretty good one. And Leonard, is this one that you you say to people in your daily life?
Yeah, it's kind of a standard reply with to crazy and unusual requests that people throw at me.
Sounds good. Leonard, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Let's go to another caller now. Darren with us in Green Bay. Darren, hi.
Yeah, hi. I don't know the specific movie, but it's a Chevy Chase line, and I use it pretty well all the time, but something along the lines of I would never call you that. And then you followed up with, as far as you know.
That, I think that's going to be from Fletch. Could that be it, Darren?
Yep, I believe it was. It was Fletch or Fletch Lives. I couldn't remember which.
Okay, yeah, that's strangely quotable. I don't know if I'd enjoy that going back and watching it 20 years later, but that one, Chevy Chase has a lot of quotable lines. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Darren. Now, is this something, Rachel, like you don't drop movie lines around the office, I'll say that I've heard.
I don't. It personally annoys me a little bit, but I do have a fondness for when my dad or friends do it. So okay. Some people can pull it off. You can pull it off, Rob. You do it all the time.
So me and your dad. So is this kind of a hashtag dad humor sort of thing?
It might be a dad thing.
I think it kind of is. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're taking your movie lines that you quote on a date, well, maybe not on a daily basis, but in your, you know, day-to-day life, something that's become part of your vocabulary. We'll go to Cindy now in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. If you build it, they will come.
That's, and that's Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams.
Couldn't think of the name there for a second. And you, this is one that you say?
I'm sorry, what's that?
Is this one that you say in your daily life?
Well, I don't know if I say it daily, but I do use it quite regularly.
Like, give us an example, a context where you might say that.
Well, I'm involved in a lot of groups that are kind of creative, so I, you know, if we come up with some creative idea, maybe don't say if you build it, but if we do that, they will come, or, you know what I mean, something.
Awesome.
Kind of
like, so. I love it, Cindy. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that one. Here's one, you know, from a movie I haven't actually ever seen in its entirety, Jerry Maguire. We heard a different clip from it earlier. Here's another one.
You complete me. And I just had...
Shut up. Just shut up. You had me at hello.
And I like to use a version of you had me at hello, but like with a really long convoluted thing. Like the example I gave was you had me at, I brought a box of donuts and we have your favorite cream filled ones in them. Like the entire statement. That's my common usage of that one.
I can attest to that.
Oh my God.
Listeners.
It is all bad humor. Maybe I should say less about myself. Back to your calls. Larry is with us in Eau Claire. Larry, hi.
Hi there. I think I remember the movie now. I think it was either Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, or it was some line, but it was, now that's going to leave a mark. And my four-year-old just said it to her twin sister not more than a day or two ago.
I feel like that's in Spaceballs, and it's John Candy when he's jumping up to get out of his chair, but the seatbelt is still on. Could that be it?
Oh, I don't remember specifically what movie it was.
But maybe it's in multiple movies, too. So that's going to leave a mark. And your four-year-old twins are on that one already.
Yep. They've heard me say it. So,
Larry, thanks a lot. So, Rachel, are you going to go watching for these now or at least try to integrate some into your vocabulary?
You know, I'm not sure if I'll try to do that myself.
Now, are you a movie buff? I don't even know this about you.
I would not consider myself a movie buff. I actually get teased more of for forgetting movie names and and actors and actresses. So definitely not.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Ron and Weyerhaeuser. Ron, hi.
Yeah, hi.
Oh, what line did you want to share?
Well, my line's from Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman.
Uh-huh.
And it's what we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah, it almost had to be that one from Cool Hand Luke.
Yep.
And boy, and that comes up, that you could use probably just about every day if you communicate with people or try to communicate with people on a regular basis, right?
Exactly. It comes up oftentimes in a meeting. I use it once in a while in meetings. But.
And depending on the age of your coworkers, do you get a lot of blank stares?
Yeah, exactly. Yep, it is generational.
Well, you keep plugging away, Ron, and maybe share a copy or tell them to stream it, I guess. Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Michael in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi there. How you doing today?
Good. What line do you have for us?
Well, I got two for you. My personal favorite of all time, I unfortunately don't get to use it that often, is leave the gun, take the cannoli.
Yeah, I don't know how you'd work that into a daily conversation too much.
Try as I might, I just can't.
You
do
need
it.
A really specific
one that
setup.
I do all the, probably once a week, I work in from grumpy old men. You can wish in one hand and crap in the other and see which fills up first.
That's a little more usable in daily conversation. Michael, thanks for that call. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Looking at your favorite movie lines, ones you quote in everyday life. Here's a movie that I think gets quoted a lot, Princess Bride.
Got very good arms.
He didn't fall? Inconceivable.
You keep using the word.
I don't think it means what you think it means.
And that I see that quoted on Twitter a lot, actually, in a political conversation. Princess Bride, have you seen that, Rachel?
I have seen it. It's also that quote is a favorite of Jeffrey Vasquez as well.
Okay.
My favorite from that movie is As You Wish.
And do you, I mean, again, when we say, hey, Rachel, can you do blank here? I never hear you say that.
No, I don't. Maybe
that's probably
I can
okay.
start
nah,
if you want.
No, I think that's okay. back to your calls now. Rana with us in Rice Lake. Hi, Rana.
Hi.
What do you got for us?
I hope I got a good one. I'm a teacher, and when a student does something kind of silly, I'll look at him and say, you're killing me, Smalls. And I don't know what that's from, but it works pretty well for me.
The Sandlot. Yeah, Sandlot. That's right. I was blocking on the name. We just talked about that movie the other day because a lot of the Brewers did a reenactment of a scene from Sandlot. I think that line might have been in there.
I think it was, yeah.
Thanks for sharing that one. Stephanie is with us now in Belleville. Stephanie, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to share with us?
Bueller. Bueller.
Okay, now how do you work? How does that come up in your conversations? If somebody's whenever not listening?
Whenever I'm in a group setting and I'm looking for a response, I'll throw that out there. It's definitely a generational thing, though. I used it with a group of middle schoolers, and they looked at me like I was nuts. And then I realized, oh my gosh, you've never seen Bueller's Day Off.
And my kids have seen that, though, when they're just a bit older than middle school now, but they would get that. But yeah, a lot of blank stares. This is pretty generational. That article we mentioned covered 40 years of movies. Have you seen all the ones, Rachel, that your dad drops?
No, definitely not. There's a big generation gap for me and my dad. And I would say even for some of the lines that you trot out every now and then, Rob.
Well, I'll try to give context. That's part of my job here. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
And thanks for all your calls. Thanks to Carl Christensen for pulling a lot more audio than we ended up using. That was Rachel Vasquez, producer for Central Time. We've been talking about famous movie lines that have changed the way we talk. Hey, don't worry, you can keep sharing yours. These are pretty punchy. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. The two black men who were arrested at a Philadelphia Starbucks a week ago today are telling their side of the story. Rashawn Nelson and Dante Robinson were on ABC's Good Morning America. If you haven't heard the story, they say they were at the Starbucks waiting to meet a potential business partner about a real estate deal. Upon entering, Nelson asked to use the restroom, but was told it was for paying customers only. So they sat at a table and waited for their meeting. A barista asked if they wanted to order anything. They declined. Shortly after, they saw police officers enter, talk with the manager, approach their table, and ask them to leave. Ultimately, they were handcuffed and taken to the police station on charges of trespassing and disturbance, charges that were dropped later that night. Video of their arrest was taken by a bystander and viewed online more than 10 million times. On Saturday, Starbucks CEO Kevin Johnson apologized to the men and said the actions are not representative of the company's mission and values. Nelson was asked this morning what he wanted to see come out of this situation.
You know, this is something that has been going on for years, and everyone's blind to it, but they know what's going on, if you get what I mean. And, you know, just really taking those actions and putting them in a place and, you know, help people understand that it's not just a black people thing. This is a people thing.
Our next guest says this isn't just a Philadelphia story or a Starbucks story. It's a story about the reality of everyday life for African Americans. Alex G. is president and founder of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development and pastor of Fountain of Life Church in Madison. He hosts a weekly podcast called Black Like Me. Reverend G., welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back again. Sorry it's under these circumstances, but thank you for having me on again.
Yeah, you posted an 8-minute video. You called it a video rant on your website in response to this. And you started by saying you're very frustrated by this situation and what it says about what's going on in the United States. Can you talk about that?
I sure can. You know, I guess whenever we get to a moment where I think maybe we can breathe and maybe things will get to some sense of normalcy, then something will make national news and national attention like this. I think what was so appalling to me is that it's not the exception, it's becoming more and more of the rule. And I just think the idea of, first of all, so when you think about what black men are dealing with at the hands of police officers, not every police officer, but certainly the cases that are highly profiled, to call the police and to have black men in Starbucks, which is really known as white space, white people's space, to have them embarrassed, handcuffed, and taken out and arrested was just over
the top, and I was embarrassed for the men. I was hurt for the men, and just felt that that was a sucker punch to the entire nation and to our attempt to be more reconciled racially.
And in that rant you talked about not that long ago, you were in a coffee shop. You're going to wait for a meeting. You were going through this mental calculus about what you should do.
Yeah, I mean, and this happened before the incident in Philly, but it's a reminder that part of what makes me as an African-American male so tired at times at these situations is that there's the additional mental calisthenics. Should I be here? Am I dressed appropriately? Is someone following me around? I've got to think about having my business card on my, you know, on my person, just the extra thought of things. I got bumped up to first class. I'm in New York today. I'm actually interviewing potential podcast guests. And I got bumped up because of points. And the flight attendant looked at me and she said, I went to the bathroom, tried to go. She said, should you really be here? And I think she sensed she saw this incredulous look in my eyes and she realized that I was sitting in first class and she said, oh, and she let me use the bathroom. But she was so accustomed to black people not sitting in first class. She actually asked me, should you really be here? And I was thinking, being like, what? I thought maybe I misunderstood her. And so this whole sense of people's perception of where black people should and shouldn't be, what they should and shouldn't be doing, is just an extra step that adds unnecessary stress to everyday black life in America. And people have just got to understand this is reality.
If something like that happened, that questioning from the steward, the flight attendant there, happened once in your life, maybe not a big deal. But what you're saying is this is kind of like a daily steady stream of just a little bit of extra scrutiny wherever you go.
Sure, sure. Now, I have to admit, nothing like that happens. Like that egregious happens every day. But I tell you what does happen. I almost wish, this is going to sound strange, but I'll be honest to say it. I almost wish that in those situations, people would just call me a name and say what they're really thinking so we can deal with it as it is. I don't know that she's a racist. I can't prove it. But I forget every other scenario until the next one happens. So what happens to us is we'll put it away. Otherwise, it'll make you insane. And so when she said, should you really be here, I immediately remembered the last six times someone followed me around, asked me a question, asked for my identification, or pulled me over my church parking lot. I rehearse every incident, and I think that that's what happens with African-American people. That you're right. If it were just the first time, I would blow it off. But when it starts happening and you know the pattern, just you brace yourself, and then you have to still play by the same standards and the same rules as your white counterparts, knowing that you're carrying these things. And now I have the pressure of teaching my daughter how to identify these things and how to navigate it when it happens, so she doesn't have the mental or the psychological disadvantage of having to always deal this or explain or be on guard.
Talking to Reverend Alex G. from Madison, looking at this story in a Philadelphia Starbucks that's getting attention and daily life for African-Americans in the United States. We heard on Facebook from Brian. He says, how about buy a cup of coffee and stop loitering? So, and this is a response I've seen. Well, these people were there. They weren't paying for anything. So Starbucks was within its rights.
Well, if they were within their rights and the men, then the charges would not have been dropped. Brian might need to actually define what loitering is, because if that's the case, we all loiter, because there are white patrons of that business who said, we were sitting here, we didn't buy anything, we were waiting for friends, and the police weren't called. They said that a jogger came in, did not buy anything, went to the bathroom to relieve himself, and left. And so I really need people like that caller, rather than just responding, because this is part of the problem. Black people have enough to do in America than to make up stuff. White people have given us enough truth so that if we want to just pick at something, we can. We don't get up each day thinking, let's make up a scenario. Those men weren't loitering. Otherwise, then the police should have arrested everyone else who had not yet purchased something. We need to look at the definition of loitering. This is a meeting space. It's not a courtroom. It was not a doctor's office. It's a meetup space. It's a coffee shop.
We're talking with Alex G. He's president and founder of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development and pastor of Fountain of Life Church in Madison. We're talking about the arrest of two black men at a Starbucks in Philadelphia. Why Reverend G. sets an example of everyday life for African Americans in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this incident, the company's handling of it, the response to it? If you are African American, does this story resonate with you? Do you feel that extra sense of scrutiny, the idea that people see you as not belonging in certain spaces? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our discussion about what it's like to live while black in America. Our guest Alex G. says the kind of incident that resulted in the arrest of two black men at a Philadelphia Starbucks last week happens more often than people think. He's the president and founder of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development and pastor of Fountain of Life Church in Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow this story? What was your reaction? What do you think about the company's plans to hold racial bias training? If you're African American, what is it like to walk in your shoes, especially here in Wisconsin, where you might really stand out in some communities? Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas@WPR.org. Reverend G, let's talk about Starbucks saying, hey, we're going to close our stores for, I think it's a half a day coming up, and have a racial bias training. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know what? Let me just say something for just a moment, if I may. If I don't say this, I'm not going to sleep well tonight. I'm thinking about the comment or the question that the gentleman just posed. You know, part of what happened during lynching or during slave auctions was that people, particularly white people, were silent. And they said, no, this was justified. The lynching was justified. The murder was justified. And I think part of the problem is people can't believe that someone would be treated differently because of their ethnic background or sexual orientation or gender. And so that disbelief allows this to be perpetuated. So part of what Starbucks got to do with their training and closing 8,000 stores is admirable. I have to say, I'm upset about what happened. I stopped drinking coffee, period, for several days. But closing down 8,000 stores is serious. I don't know that any international, multinational organization has done that. So kudos. But I think they've got to have shrewd people helping them with the training, because there are people in their employment who don't believe that this can happen. Or I've heard comments saying, well, you know, I have friends who are baristas in Philly, and they have to call the police a lot because people were going in the bathroom and they were shooting up and they were using. I said, excuse me, those are extreme cases of individuals who may have been homeless who were doing drugs. These men were professionals. They weren't doing drugs, and they were waiting for their third member to come. Then they would order coffee. Let's stop comparing someone with mental health issues who might be homeless and addicted to heroin to someone who is black and trying to do a real estate deal. You know, people keep trying to make the comparisons. So I think the big work of Starbucks company is not how to treat black people when they come in the door. It's asking staff, why do we think certain things about certain people? Where do those implicit biases come from? And that's where Starbucks has got to start. That's a great start on that afternoon in May. But that's the beginning of a lot of work, because we are not as ready as a nation as we think we are to believe that that can happen to black people in this country.
Let's bring on a caller now. Michelle is with us in Madison. Michelle, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Michelle?
So I'm a seventh grade teacher in Cross Plains, and my students and I just finished our speaking about Reconstruction, which was following the Civil War, and we talk about how during that time people, you know, talked about African Americans regaining their rights and getting full citizenship, and the kids come to the realization that really, that they really didn't. And then yesterday we had a lesson, which is, you know, so similar to what you're talking about, where we spoke about biases and discrimination, and I brought up many cases of the things that you're talking about today. And at the end of the lesson, the kids all brought up different things, and I showed them articles and different news stories about how bias happens in so many ways, you know, with African Americans, with people, you know, transgender, with gays and lesbians, you know, due to religious biases, and just how, you know, we all need to know, and we all need to have that awareness that this was something that happened 150 years ago, but truly it does exist, and that kids need to be educated and keep their eyes open and be the first ones to speak out against this if they see it happening.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Alex talking there about bias today and in history.
Sure. The question I continue to ask my non-black colleagues and allies is, when did we push the reset button and to say we don't feel this way about certain people groups? We just assumed that because we changed legislation, we changed hearts, and we didn't. And don't forget, even when slavery ended, hearts didn't. It's why Reconstruction only lasted 10 or 15 years. It's why we saw the onset of Jim Crow, because the law said it was illegal to enslave people, but we found other ways to treat people and denigrate people. So we do have to do that, but we have to ask the question why, because it's benefiting someone. It's helping someone. It's not just being spiteful and mean. There are systems, and there's commerce and economies that are built around the mistreatment of folks. So we have to understand how ugly this whole animal is if we're really going to dismantle it. And that's why I really hope that the leaders of Starbucks will use not only national leaders, but regional and local leaders who know their local communities, who can really come in and help them with their staff, because they have made a bold move, but I don't think they have the wherewithal to really walk their staff through it. And I think that they should really benefit from champions in their own local communities. That would be a great symbol of hope and partnership to help them bring their staff into the reality that this is still here, and addressing it is the first major step to eradicating it.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Brett in Houstonsford. Brett, hi.
How you doing, bud?
What do you think?
Well, I got two different stories for you. Years back, when my kids were little, we went to a big box store to buy a hot water heater. And I mean, all three of my friends, I'm white, my buddies are white. We walk into the store, and we look kind of shabby or whatever, but, you know, we were buying a hot water heater. But my one friend was big with the fire department and had a scanner. He locked into their security system. They followed us all around the store.
Brett, thanks for sharing that story. He's saying as a white person, he was followed in a store. Alex, but it sounds like you're saying as an African-American, that might not be once or twice in your life. It might be once or twice a day.
No, and first of all, he is infuriated because he knows that probably by the way he was dressed or how he looked, people made certain assumptions about him. He has every right to be upset. And I don't like to compare scars, but what I would say is I live in a big box store. I wish that it only happened when I went to Circuit City or Best Buy. But what happens when I go into a store, apply for a job, go to see a doctor? I've shown up with my white assistant, and people have extended a hand to him and say, "You must be Dr. G." Because the assumption is I must be the special assistant or the driver, because there's no way I could be Dr. G. I won't even say these places now, but I've gone to places, business establishments, where they have valet services, and I was walking in for a meeting, and a woman walked out and handed me her car keys because she assumed I was a valet. I was walking in. I had a suit on. I was invited as a special guest, but the assumption is she walked out, she didn't ask me my name, and there were men with coveralls, baseball caps, and name tags. She gave me her car keys, put them in my hand, and told me what kind of car she drove. It was not in a box store. That's living black in America.
Talking to Reverend Alex G. about living black in America. We'll take a Facebook comment here from Nate. Nate writes, I'm a 78-year-old African-American in Madison. When I go into any business, the thought that I'm being watched because I'm black turns on. Do I feel relaxed? Never. Outright bigotry is subtle here, he writes. African-Americans can feel it. I would think this is true for Native Americans and Latino Americans as well. What do you think?
I think it's very true. And just because it's subtle does not mean its impact is subtle. You shoot someone with a gun or a silencer, I mean, full grain or a silencer, it still hurts the same. And so black folks are not asked to be pitied. We're just trying to say we know that this is a reality, and we still compete with our white counterparts for jobs, promotions, loans, et cetera. But I'm glad that interviewers like you and others are at least bringing it to light. Because, again, we're not asking for pity. We just want people to know
that's not isolated in Philly, and it's not just Starbucks. It's what so many of us feel when we go to a conference. Can we all sit together? Will it look like we're not, you know? There's so many extra steps. It's the mental calisthenics. It's why I actually created my podcast, Black Like Me, because I want people just to see how I chronicle my life and for non-blacks just to listen in. It's not a gripe session. It's the good and the bad, but just being enlightened into the extra steps we have to take as African-Americans in order to just be average in America.
Let's bring on another caller now. Andy is with us in Kaukauna. Andy, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Andy?
Well, I heard the guest, the Reverend there, earlier talking about a double standard, but also making blanket statements about white people. Additionally, in the media and over the last year or two, I've noticed there's a lot of blanket statements about white people or white males. Personally, I think too progressive a society. I think that it needs to be recognized that racism is everywhere, bias is everywhere, and I believe everyone has that within them to some extent, and I think work needs to be done to, again, move past that or to progress as a society.
Andy, thanks for the call. Reverend G, he says, painting white people with too broad a brush.
You know, I hear his point. So he's feeling some particular way about hearing that in the last two or three years. Well, imagine America's blanket statements and feeling about black people the last 400 years. He's having difficulties dealing with the last 2 weeks. Imagine doing it for the last, almost what's half of a millennium. We all have implicit biases, but black people don't own enough Starbucks to arrest white people who threaten them. And that's the difference. We're not saying that that black people don't have, that we lack prejudicial views. That's not what we're saying. But Starbucks is created as white space. Places that are clearly designated as black space are rarely frequented by whites. But when you have space that is like Starbucks that's known as a place that where just white America gathers, we're just saying what happens to black people when they're there. Now, when these incidents happen, they happen by black people. It's not Latino people doing it to us. They don't own that Starbucks. It's not Asian folks, Asian American folks are doing that in those situations. So I never say all white people, but when I say white people feel or think have said to me, that's because in my experience as a 54-year-old black man in America, this is what I've experienced by white people. But I'm not saying all white people, but all the people that have done it to me have been white.
That's all the time we have. Reverend G, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Alex G is the president and founder of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development and pastor of Fountain of Life Church in Madison. He also hosts a weekly podcast. It's called Black Like Me. We talked with him about the arrest of two black men at a Philadelphia Starbucks, which will also be the focus of his next podcast. You can still share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your thoughts and maybe your experiences. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the owners of Boston Store, Yonkers, and other department stores are trying to sell off their assets, the latest in a long line of bad news for established retail stores. We'll look at the impact that's going to have on jobs and consumers here in Wisconsin, and we'll ask you if you've changed the way you shop, if online shopping has taken over for you, if you go to different kinds of stores than you used to go to. Also tomorrow, we'll meet the Wisconsin musicians behind a unique musical tribute to legendary conservationist John Muir. Hear more about his connection with us here in Wisconsin, too. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we're turning up the heat after a week filled with lots and lots of snow. Lori Skelton gives us a hot sauce for just about every occasion. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.